Man, welcome everybody. Welcome to Mercy Hill Church. We're excited that you're here with us and worshiping with us tonight. We are going to continue to work through the book of Esther tonight. We've been doing that for 6 or 7 weeks in a row now. Tonight's going to be no different from that. And so if you have a copy of Scripture, if you brought a Bible with you, I'm going to go ahead and invite you to take that out and go ahead and find the book of Esther in your Bible. That's where we're going to spend our time tonight. If you didn't bring one, it's okay. Our verses and stuff for the night will be up on the screen. But I wanted to begin tonight with kind of a saying that people say in culture, something you guys have probably heard at some point in your life, and kind of apply that to our sermon, all right? So I'm going to use the word whatever in the blank, but you'll kind of see where I'm going, all right? So have you ever heard the expression, like, you can take the boy out of the whatever, but you can't take the whatever out of the boy or girl? Okay, so it's kind of like, man, you can take the boy out of the mountains, but you can't take the mountains out of the boy. I don't know if you ever heard that before. Something like with a farm. You know, somebody was raised on a farm, like, hey, once a farmer, always a farmer. You can take them off the farm, but, you know, you can't take the farm out of them. Well, I think that's something that we say in our culture a lot. It's definitely something that you end up hearing in music. Let me give you two examples that are sort of on opposite ends of the spectrum, all right? So I grew up in Middleburg, Florida, the birthplace of Lynyrd Skynyrd, okay? Skynyrd has a song, if you look at any of their greatest hits albums, that's called All I Can Do Is Write About It. It's just like this little acoustic jam that they do, and it's all about the South and being raised out in the country and all this kind of stuff. So the culmination of the song, though, is where they sing, you can take the boy out of old Dixieland, but you'll never take old Dixie from a boy. Okay, kind of that idea. Like, you can take them out, but there's something in them that has, there's something that has been shaped in them that you'll never get all the way out, okay? Sort of on, you know, if you think about classic rock and Southern, sort of on the opposite end of that a little bit, maybe not all the way, sort of on the opposite end will be like Snoop Dogg, okay? Or dubbed Snoop Lion now, from what I understand, all right? So he's kind of on this other spectrum. Same idea. Totally different dude, same exact idea. You look at his song called Raised in the Hood. It's all about being raised on the east side of Long Beach. What does the song say? It says, you can take me out of the hood, but you can't take the hood up out of me. Okay? So if you look at these two, half of you in here are going like, how in the world does Snoop Dogg and Skynyrd get into a sermon? This is how they get in. You know, you may agree with their music, not agree with their music, whatever. That's not, the point is, musicians often are, they're storytellers about our culture is what they are. They're people who look in, and they're people who look into the culture, and they say, this is what I'm seeing in the culture. Now, if you have two people on such opposite ends of the spectrum who are singing about the same thing, I think they're showing something in culture that's right. I think it is right. What are they saying? This is exactly what they're saying. They're saying, you are who you are. That's it. You are who you are. You can take you out and put you in another situation, but you are still you. You can take you out of the South, but you're still you. You can take you out of the hood, but you're still you. You are who you are. It's like Popeye says, I am what I am. You are you, and you're not someone else, right? I think that tailors into our point for tonight, because here's the deal. So many of us, while this is true, and there has been an identity that has marked us, like something like being raised in a place that marks you so much that you can be out of that place and still be that place, that has happened for us in the gospel of Jesus Christ. For Christians, people who have moved from death to life, you have been given a new identity. And it should be an identity that you can be in any situation, and you know what? It still is what it is. And you are who you are. Old-time preachers, I was raised like old-time preachers would say, I mean, they would try to convince you that when you became a Christian, your DNA physically changed. Like if you took blood or whatever, you would see a different strand because your identity is something new. That's kind of true for a Christian. That's not actually true for a Christian, but the idea is true for a Christian. You are something new. Now, here's the deal. If that's true of us, and we have been given a new identity, and we are new people, what does it say about our faith and how we're believing the gospel and how we're growing in our faith if we aren't who we are depending on the situation that we're in? That it's not true of us that you can take us out of the South or take us out of the hood and we're still who we are. You can put us in different situations and we're not really acting like Christians anymore. See, for many of us, and a lot of areas of our faith are this way, that our Christianity is not so much of an identity that everything flows from. Everything we do flows out of, and it's more like a hat that we put on and take off. Or it's more like a radio that we kind of turn off and turn on. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, oh, it's Sunday night, it's church night. Let me go to the closet and get my church hat. I wear my church hat for a couple hours, and then I take it back off. This is my Christian hat, you know? Or it's Wednesday night, it's time to do community. Haven't really done community all week, haven't loved each other well and neighbored well and done life in community, but it's community group night on Wednesday night, so let me get my hat and put that on. Or let me turn the music on for my Christianity because I'm having a bad day, but something tells me that my Christianity, I need to put a silly grin on my face. So I'm going to turn the music on today. I got coworkers getting in the car with me, so let me change the radio station to K-Love. let me turn the radio on, okay? So, you know what I mean? It's the radio's on or off in our life, rather than the radio should always be on if you're a Christian. Everything flows out of our identity. It's actually who we are, who we have become. See, I think that nowhere in our Christian lives is this more evident than when it comes to mission. When it comes to sharing Jesus with others, when it comes to being about going to the ends of the earth and making sure the gospel message is known. This is the area of our life where I feel like many of us, we take that part of our Christianity, we put it on like a hat, and we take it off. I'm on mission whenever the church does something that's mission. The church does it, you know, it's July and they're doing, and it's a big festival downtown or whatever. I'll go and I'll do mission. I'll be at the diaper changing station or whatever Mercy Hill's about. I'll put that on. But like tomorrow at work, I've kind of turned the music off. Like it's not flowing out of my identity. It's a hat on, hat off. Here's what I want us to see tonight from Esther chapter 8. In Esther's life, we have seen a roller coaster. In Esther's life, we have seen a character transformation. But by Esther chapter 8, what we have seen is a woman who has been changed by the grace of God. And as she has been changed, she has realized that in salvation, I'm not only saved, but I'm sent. My identity now is something new. In the core DNA of who I am both saved in the gospel and sent by the gospel to be a missionary to my people, right? That's the big idea I want us to see tonight. I think we get there from Esther chapter 7 and 8. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to go through two chapters of the Bible tonight. It's kind of a long story, but we got to get it all. And so just, man, hang with me the best we can. And then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about that one big idea about what it means to be saved and sent. Christians are missionaries. How does that work out in our lives, all right? Esther chapter 7, verse 1 and 2 kind of alert us to what we saw last week. Now, if you haven't been with us, I don't have time to go back through the whole story, but Esther is a girl who is found in a situation where she has a chance to stand in on behalf of all of her people. Her people are under the threat of death. They're under the knife, if you think about it. A day is coming when they are all going to die. And she has an opportunity to go before the king, risking her own life, to beg for their lives. Last week, she brings the king to a feast, and he asks her what she wants, and she punts. And she says, I'll tell you tomorrow. Well, Esther chapter 7 is that tomorrow. She has come before the king in this feast, and he has finally looked at her in her eyes and said, Esther, what do you want from me? Verse 3. Then Queen Esther said, If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish and my people for my request, my life and my people, for we have been sold, and my people to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. Esther has stood in for her people yet again, but this time there is nothing left. Everything's on the table. Xerxes, I'm a Jew. I am one of them. These are my people. If you come to the Bible and you look at Esther and you're like, I don't know if she really gets it or not, by the end of the book, she gets it. The reason she gets it is because she doesn't ask that they be saved. She doesn't say, will you save God's people? She says, me. I'm one of them. They are my kindred. She identifies with them here. And y'all, this is a big deal, and I want you to know why. We all read the story of Esther, and we know the end of the story, so it's not that dramatic for us. When she identifies herself to the king as a Jew, she outs herself. If the king doesn't receive this favorably, she has marked herself for death. She has basically said, I am one of the people who will be slaughtered here in a couple months. Verse 5, then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, well, who is he? And where is he who has dared to do this? He's mad. And Esther said, a foe, an enemy, the wicked Haman. Now, if you've been with us throughout this series, you realize Haman is the guy who has orchestrated the death of all of these Jews because he's got an ego complex. He's very evil, very wicked, wants them all to die. He wants all the glory for himself. This is who Haman is. And now the king is angry, asks Esther, who is the one that has done all of this? And she says, it's Haman. Haman is his closest friend. Haman is his most trusted advisor, but it is Haman who has sold all the Jews and his very queen under the threat of death. So the king doesn't know what to do. Let me just jump through the story. The king doesn't know what to do. He's filled with wrath, and he walks out into the garden is what it says. Okay? Haman at this point realizes the gig's up. You guys can just go read it later. He realizes it's the gig's up. He's mad. She's a Jew. I didn't quite think that all the way through. She's with Mordecai and all. I mean, he realizes the gig's up. So here's what he does. He goes to Esther and he falls on his knees and he begs for his life. What an absolute picture of literary and poetic irony. The man who wanted all the Jews to grovel to him now bows before Queen Esther, the Jew. Also, the adopted daughter of Mordecai, his mortal enemy. And now he is bowing for them. Now watch what else happens. When the king walks in, Haman is in this gesture of falling before the queen. Guess what happens? He trips and stumbles and falls on top of her onto the couch. Right as the king walks in, he sees Haman on top of his wife on the couch. This is the most powerful man in the world. And Haman is now standing with his wife on this couch. And the king looks in and he says, wow, Haman, even you would assault my wife in my very palace. And at that moment, the bag comes over his head. The gig's up. The dudes grab him. They put the bag over his head and they begin to usher him out. Verse 9, then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance with the king, said, moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high. And the king said, hang him on that. How do you like that? Haman has raised the gallows. Harbona walks in, bags over Haman's head. And Harbona's like, hey, wait a minute. There's a huge gallows outside. It's 70 feet tall. We got a 70-foot tall spike to go ahead and hang someone on. Haman built it for Mordecai. Let's just go ahead and hang Haman on it. It's perfect, perfect irony for what happens. The king said, hang him on that. And so they hanged Haman on the gallows that he prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated. See, one good thing for us to know, you think about Haman. The reality is that we all bow before God's providence and his plan. We all bow. Some of us do it willingly, submitting to God, saying, I love. And some of it do it in fear of their life. For Haman, it was too late. Maybe true of us. Haman's dead. Esther and Mordecai are alive. The story should be over, right? That's it. What else is there to go? Well, there's the rest of this sermon and then two more. Because the book doesn't end there, and this is why. The immediate threat to Esther and Mordecai is gone, but chapter 8 continues. Watch what happens. On the day the king Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman. Perfect irony. Now everything Haman wanted, even his house, has been given over to the Jews and to God's people, the enemy of the Jews. Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her, and the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai, and Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. The king confiscates Haman's property. He's kind of a traitor, undermine the king, confiscates his property, and gives it to Mordecai. Perfect. Now, Herodotus is a historian from this time. He tells us that this is very common among the kings of that day. If a man's a traitor, take everything that they have and give it to somebody else. So, I don't want you to get it twisted. I don't believe the Bible because of the history. But some of you in here may not be Christians at all. Don't read your Bible. And that's great, man. I'm glad that you're here. I just think it's a good thing for you to know that history back. Go ahead and try to look up and really study how many historical accounts the Bible has that are wrong when squared against true good history. I would love for you to study that if you're kind of studying these things. You'll find one here that coincide perfectly. But really, what has happened here? Well, there's a massive gap between chapter 7 and chapter 8, and if you're just reading through it, you might have already missed it. See, Esther and Mordecai, they're good, everything's fine. But what has not happened from the end of chapter 7 to the first couple of verses of chapter 8? What is glaringly absent from the story? no new edict has been issued. The Jews are still going to die here in a few months. Verse 3, then Esther spoke again to the king. She fell at his feet and wept and pleaded to avert the evil plan of Haman the Agagite and the plot that he devised against the Jews. And when the king held out his golden scepter, the second time that this scene has happened, right? Where she goes in uninvited, the king can either hold his scepter out or not. It's like Gladiator, thumbs up, thumbs down. You're either dead or he's going to accept you into his presence. Now, we teach this story to little kids. We don't teach them that she went before the king two times a lot of times. We teach about the such a time as this and the big time where she goes before the king. I think this is actually more courageous that she went in before him again. And I'm going to tell you why in just a minute, all right? Verse 5, Esther rose and stood before the king and she said, if it please the king and I have found favor in his sight, and if the thing seems right before the king and I am pleasing in his eyes, let an order be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are on all the provinces of the king. For how can I bear to see the calamity that is coming upon my people? Or how can I bear to see the destruction of my kindred? Then King Ahasuerus said to the queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman. They have hanged him on the gallows because he intended to lay hands on the Jews. What's he saying? He's saying, I've already done all this stuff for you, Esther. I mean, woman, what else do you want from me? That's kind of what he's getting at. That's the line that I use in my house, okay? Woman? No, that's not really true. That's kind of what, if you read the commentaries and stuff, that's kind of what he's saying. It's like he's wanting to put before Esther and Mordecai, like, hey, it's not like I have not been generous to you already. But verse 8, but you may write as you please with regard to the Jews. Now listen, we've got to be good Bible readers and interpreters at this point, okay? If you have been tracing with me through this series, what you're going to realize is that everything that we're about to read sounds eerily familiar to you. It sounds point by point like another story in the book of Esther. The same exact thing happens, different characters. If you go back to chapter 3 and you read all the way through from the beginning, everything that we're going to see and hear about is something that we have seen before, not to Mordecai and for life, but for Haman and for death. All right, this is a long section. Keep it in your mind. Read it with me. Okay, you may write as you please with regard to the Jews in the name of the king and seal it with the king's ring, for an edict written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's ring cannot be revoked. We've seen that before. The king's scribe were summoned at that time in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day, and an edict was written according to all that Mordecai commanded the Jews. We've seen that before. To the satraps, to the governors, to the officials, to the provinces, to India, blah, 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 everybody in their own language. We've seen that before, verse 10. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed it with the king's ring. We've seen that before. Then he sent the letters by mounted couriers riding on swift horses that were used in the king's service, bred from the royal stud. We've seen that before. Saying that the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and to defend themselves, to destroy, to kill, to annihilate any armed force of any people or province that might attack them, children and women included, and to plunder their goods on one day throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus on the 13th day of the 12th month, or the month of Adar, a copy of what was written to be issued as a decree in every province being publicly displayed to all peoples, and the Jews were to be ready on that day to take vengeance on their enemies. Have not seen that before. Very interesting part of the Bible. The Jews take vengeance. Women, children, kill, organize yourself. Mordecai has the chance to write whatever he wants, and that's what he writes. Now, I know some of you in here, the reality is, like I said, man, you've come, you're not a believer, you're checking out the church. Thank you for being here, honestly. But the reality is that for some of you, this might be the very reason that you're not a believer. Someone has pointed you to four or five times in the Old Testament where you see God say something like this, like, oh, just go ahead and take everybody out. And you don't know what to do with it, and you think that there's no answer to be had. How could you ever follow a God like this? Honestly, fair enough. If I wasn't a believer and I feel like I hadn't studied these things, I would be in the exact same place. But here's what I would ask you. I don't have time to deal with this right now, but I'm going to deal with it next week. Right? I'm going to deal with this exactly next week. We're going to talk a lot about this next week. What do you do with a passage like this in the Bible? We're going to talk about it next week. And I would push you and urge you to come back and to be a part of that discussion. You might be thinking in your mind, I don't want to push too much if you give me a little bit of liberty here, but I'm just going to say it. If you're thinking in your mind right now, like, I don't need to come back, there's no possible answer for this, but you've never heard one or heard someone try to explain it. If that's what you're thinking, there's no answer, but you've never really heard an explanation, that is the very definition of being closed-minded, by definition. I would push you not to be that. All I can ask as a pastor is to say, man, come, hear me out, let's talk about it, and then make an informed decision. And if you come out on the other side, that's, we'll respect each other and move on. But come and hear it out, all right? I can't deal with it now. We're going to deal with it next week. Verse 15. Let's finish this up. Then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a great golden crown and a robe of fine linen and purple. And the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. I wish I could stop after like every sentence. The city itself was in an uproar, not in mourning, but in joy. The Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor, and in every province and in every city where they went, the king's command and his edict reached. There was gladness and joy among the Jews, a feast and a holiday, which is still observed to this day, mind you. And many from the peoples of the country declared themselves Jews, for fear of the Jews had fallen on them. Y'all, this is a long story, I know that. Two chapters of the Bible, very involved, okay? Years of many of you in this congregation watching the show Seinfeld has moved your brain into a place where it's very hard to hold a lot of things together. It's not like 30 seconds at a time, okay? I know that. I am one of those people. What we need to do is say, okay, for a few minutes, I'm going to try to hold this entire narrative in my brain, keep it all together, strung together, because in doing that, we're going to be able to, I think, extract what the Bible is pushing us to see here, okay? Esther in the big picture, Esther stands in for her people, pushes us to see Jesus stand in for us, big picture. Esther 7 and 8, kind of the narrow view, what's the theme of this part of the Bible? Here's the theme of this part of the Bible. It's mission. It's looking at Esther's life and saying, this is what it looks like to be saved and sent, all right? I want to talk to you about what it looks like for Christians to be missionaries in our culture. I got 3 points tonight. The first one is this. Christians are missionaries. That's it. Christians are missionaries. It's a DNA thing. It's an identity thing. The way that God saves me is a sending way, okay? It's not saved and then later I'm pushed to learn how to be sent. No, it's in my very salvation. Something has been done for me that pushes me to see this news go forward to people that I influence, people that I am around, and people all over the world. I want you to see that in Esther's life, all right? The first thing to see here is that Esther's salvation is what pushes her to see and long for the salvation of her people. God had saved her. It was through divine intervention, all of his ordinary providences that we talked about in our community groups this week, all of this stuff leads up, and she is saved. When she sees her salvation in chapter 7, the beginning of chapter 8, it pushes her to long for and not be satisfied until she has gone in and asked for the salvation of her people. So let's just get where the rubber meets the road for us, okay? If we aren't longing to see the salvation of others, what does that mean that we believe about the salvation God has enacted for us, for ourselves? If part of our week is not this idea of out of an identity thing, who I am, saved and sent, I'm on mission to the world, to my work, to my school, and to the world, what does that say about what I am believing about how God has saved me? See, when we see the miracle about what God has given us, when we see the miracle about the way that he has saved us, when we see how love so amazing was in play in our own salvation story, that's the catalyst. The way that he saved us, he has sent us to be catalysts in other people's salvation. How miraculous was your salvation? Well, let's talk about it for just a minute. See, tonight we talk about Esther being a missionary to her people. She stands in on their behalf. Jesus was the ultimate missionary for you. Like Esther's people were sitting under condemnation, you and I and everybody we know and everybody in this world sits under condemnation from God in their sin. They have rebelled, they have run away, and in their sin, They deserve death. They deserve to walk off of the face of this earth and not walk into an eternity with God, because he will not be with sin. He will not be with wickedness and evil. He will be separated from that. That's what we deserve. That is where we are. See, there is a law of sin and death that reigns over us. And just like the law of the Medes and the Persians that we see in the book of Esther, that law, you sin, you die. That law can't just be erased. It can't just be revoked. What needs to happen is that another law supersedes it, and that is what we end up having in Christ. See, Esther stepped in on behalf of her people under the threat of death. Jesus didn't just be threatened with death. Jesus took death on our behalf. See, we deserve death and a grave and hell. He took all in order that we would see none. In the Esther story, the wicked die so that the righteous can live. We're going to see that next week. In the true gospel story, the true missionary story, the righteous dies in order that the wicked, me, the wicked, you, might have an opportunity to live with Christ in his resurrection. See, when we actually begin to get what Esther is pointing us to, ultimately, cosmically, our salvation begins to open up our eyes. Why? Because we had a need. I want to help others with their need. Why? Because I had a need. God has met the greatest need I ever had in this life, the need of a Savior, of reconciliation to him. This is why Christians are missionaries. God has met my need. And I wake up and I see people all over the world that have the same need that I have, integral to our DNA. See, this is how we should view it. Let me go back to the opening illustration from the beginning of the message, okay? This is how we should view it. We should be like, man, I wake up tomorrow. Why am I on mission? I'm not on mission because I grabbed a hat out of a closet. Like, this is my safe. This is my evangelism. This is my Christian hat. I didn't just turn the music on to say, well, you know, the music's been off for a while, but man, Andrew really motivated me to be a missionary, so I'm going to turn that part of my life on for just wrong. What we ought to be is we wake up tomorrow and we say, man, I've been saved and sent. In my salvation, I'm sent. Out of my identity, you put me in different circumstances. You put me on a mission trip. You put me at something the church is doing. Or you just put me at work and in my class tomorrow. I'm the same. I'm who I am. It's me. It should come out in some degree, in some way. Okay? You are who you are. Think about that illustration from the beginning again. You are who you are, no matter what situation. You never see, in our culture, you always see this with rednecks. Okay? Just honest. You can dress a dude up as much as you want to do. You go to college, get a degree, all that kind of stuff. At the end of the day, if you've been raised out in the country somewhere or whatever, you kind of are who you are. And I'm going to throw myself under the bus here in just a minute. But, I mean, you think about it. You just think about it for a minute. It's like you go, you know, you work with a dude. You go to a business lunch. Or, no, business breakfast. It's like 7 a.m. in the morning. There's like six of y'all sitting at a little table. Everyone's ordering, like, you know, omelet, biscuits, whatever. And this dude comes around, he orders his omelet, and then he orders a large Mountain Dew at 7 a.m. And you're like, caught you. You know? I caught you, bro. That is the mountain, that is the redneck, you know, that's the sun drop of the gods right there. That's it. It's 7 a.m. I mean, I've seen this with some of my buddies, you know, like I got a buddy named Ken down in South Carolina, huge redneck, love the dude. I mean, this guy sits down at my house. Anna's like made us a nice like French toast breakfast. He grabs two Mountain Dew cans out of our refrigerator, pops one, crushes it. I mean, drinks the whole thing down so that he can enjoy his second one with breakfast, you know? You look at this and you go like, hey, man, you know, you dress up nice and you're kind of, but at the end of the day, who you are is going to kind of come out. I think that about myself. Many of you have seen this in a few different ways, but like one perfect way is like you come to our church and like, I mean, I try to, you know, you always see I'm up here in like a classic slim fit t-shirt from Old Navy and trying to look real. Then you come to my house on a Saturday afternoon, and I am wearing no shirt, camo Crocs, and jorts, okay? Jeans that are cut off. And you're like, caught ya. And I'm like, so has everybody else on Lewiston Road. They all drive by when they see me in the yard, and they're giving me a thumbs up and beeping the horn, you know? And it's like, hey, you can try to, eventually in your life, who you are comes out, right? Eventually, some kind of way. See, what I want you to see is this. Your identity as a Christian isn't an on and off. It's not like the volume, it's not like I'm turning the radio on or turning it off. True mission in this sense, saved and sent, the volume might turn up or turn down. That's a dangerous illustration that I'm about to give you. Don't push it too far. Every illustration breaks down eventually. But the volume might turn up or turn down in your life depending on the situation that you're in, but the radio is always on. Why? It's your identity. I'm always on mission. The volume might go up or down. I had a chance to be in Peru a few months ago. Many of you guys knew that. We had 7 days. My kids weren't there. My wife wasn't there. I didn't really have to work. I mean, there's no internet. I have 7 days to get in the Word, to realize that I'm saved, and to be sent. The volume was way up. Trying to share Jesus with everybody that I can have an opportunity to in a good, tasteful, meaningful way, you know, and trying to talk ministry, encourage missionaries that are there. Ministry's up. This summer, we did a kids camp for all of our kids. We love kids at Mercy Hill. We did a little kids camp. They had a 3-day thing, a little pool party one day that, you know, ends in a Bible story and a lunch, and, you know, went to the bounce house one day and party and a lunch and Bible story. All of our helpers that came with that, man, for 3 or 4 hours that day, it's not a Christian hat they put on and take off. Hopefully what it is, it's an identity. I'm on mission every day, but for this day, I've got 3 hours with these kids. The volume's way up, you know? Hey, you go to work tomorrow and you sit in an office and it's very businesslike and there are rules and regulations. You're still on mission. The volume may turn down at some point, you know? You may not be able to just walk in with like a Mercy Hill t-shirt on or whatever. You may be in a more of a established environment than that. The volume may turn down some, but you're just as on mission. You see what I mean? This is what it looks like for our lives when we are flowing out of our identity. Where are the areas in your life that you know it's more like cutting it on and off rather than turning the volume up and down? Where are the areas in your life where you know it's more like putting a hat on and off than it is actually living out of who I am? Christians are sent. What is it? Is it your workplace? Is it your family? You know, I mean, is it in your neighborhood? Where is that place where you feel like, man, I'm just taking the hat on and off? I would push you to say tomorrow, just remember this, Christians are missionaries. It's who you are. It's integral. If I'm saved, I'm sent. There's not an and, not an either or. It's a both. If I'm saved, I'm sent. You can take me out of whatever situation, but I am who I am. New DNA in Christ. How does that look in your life tomorrow, all right? The second point I want you to see is this. Throw it up there. Missionaries are agents of gospel change, okay? The first point is about me, who I am. Who I am as a Christian is a missionary. The second point is about what missionaries do. What missionaries do is bring the news. They bring news that has a changing effect. They're agents of gospel change. Missionaries bring the great news of reversal. At the end of this story, what you end up seeing in chapter 8 is that if you dig into your word and you begin to really see what the Bible is doing, the Bible in chapter 1 through 8 in Esther's story is setting up for you everything that is against God's plan, everything that is sad, everything that is evil. And then what you begin to see in chapter 7 and chapter 8 is that systematically what the Bible is doing is showing you that every single one of those things is being knocked down. What's the big point? The big point is that what God is doing is bringing the reversal. All that is wicked, all that is evil, all that is death, these things are going to come life. They are going to be light. You see what I mean? That's what you see. That's why when we were reading through chapter 8, I kept saying, like, seen that before, seen that before. King's signet ring, oh, seen that before. Swift horses, seen that before. It was Haman and death, chapter 3 or 4 or whatever. But now it's Mordecai and life. Yeah, that's the story of the whole Bible. The world is broken, and God is reversing all that is broken to make it unbroken. That's it. That's the story of the Bible. You need a one sentence of the Bible. Through Jesus, all that is sad is coming untrue, to borrow the language from The Lord of the Rings. If you've ever seen that, if you've ever read the book, The Lord of the Rings, okay? I don't know if you ever read it before. If you've seen it, Samwise looks at Gandalf, and he says, Gandalf, it's this moment where he thought Gandalf was dead. Gandalf walks in. He goes, Gandalf, I thought you were dead. Listen. And then Sam says, well, I thought I was dead. And then he says, what's happening in the world? Is everything sad coming untrue? And Gandalf looks back at Sam, and he says, a great shadow has been lifted. You're right. See, I'm about to get into a bunch of practical stuff. I'm about to get into a bunch of stuff that's like, hey, you need to do this, and you need to do that. That's coming in just a minute. Before we ever can get there, what you have to realize is that fundamentally, to the core, the only thing that brings change is this message of reversal. We are carriers. We are ambassadors. It's the message. The message is of the great reversal. The reversal is, yes, in your sin, you deserve death and hell. It doesn't have to be that way. You can have life. You can have heaven. See, the great reversal is that while you ought not to be able to enjoy God at all, you can enjoy God. Jesus has made a situation to where you can reach in and commune with the divine, that those who've died in Christ will live again. This is the story of reversal, that all the sickness and death that ravages this world, it will be reversed. That's the message. Missionaries are agents of gospel change. Why? Because they bring out a gospel change message, a message of reversal. My little girl's 4 years old. I got a little four-year-old girl. I don't know why she's gotten into this, but honestly, over the last 2 weeks, every time she walks in our room, she looks up on our mirror, and on our mirror is a picture of me and the greatest dog who ever lived named Lucy, okay? Now, I said it, who has lived? Lucy's not with us anymore. And for whatever reason, Hattie Jo always looks up at this picture, and she sees the dog, and she's heard me talk about Lucy, how good Lucy was with the kids, and how she's very protective, and how she could track a deer, and all this kind of stuff. You know, she was awesome. And she's heard me say all this. For whatever reason, she'll walk in and look up at that picture, and she will start crying. And she'll say, I just miss Lucy. I just miss her so much. And I'm like, Hattie Jo, you met Lucy once in your whole life, okay? And you were about 3 days old or whatever, you know what I mean? But I'm like, you know what I do? Here's what I say to her. This is what I say. I say, babe, I say, Lucy was awesome. She was so great. And you know what? Lucy died. But I'll tell her. I'll say, Hattie Jo, here's the thing. I bet you anything, Lucy is waiting on me in heaven. I bet you that she is waiting on me to get there, and she is just going to jump on me as soon as I get there. And Hattie Jo's face will kind of light up. Now, look, I have no clue if that dog's in heaven, okay? I don't know. I've never studied these things. The only thing I know about dogs going to heaven is a jacked up movie I watched when I was a little kid that many some of y'all watched when you were a little kid. No clue if they got a soul or not. Really don't care. That's not true. I do care, okay? I'm taking that opportunity. What am I speaking to my little girl? Here's what I'm saying. I'm saying, baby, everything that is sad is coming untrue. Everything that's sad is, that's the news. Reversal. It changes lives. Without this news, the Bible says without the vision, the people perish, right? What's the vision? The Bible tells us that how is anyone going to have any change unless they hear the gospel of change is what Paul says in Romans 10. How will they hear without someone to preach to them? See, that's the catch, is it not? The catch is we are agents of gospel change. The only way anyone changes is if they hear the news. Are they hearing the news? Is it coming from your mouth? Are you an agent of gospel change? I'm not talking about random acts of kindness. I'm not talking about being a good person, having like a, you know, part in like a community garden or whatever. Not that that's anything wrong with that. But what I'm saying is that's not gospel change. Gospel change is this message. Are you speaking this message? Now let me get to the practical. I think that Esther gives us four things to honestly look at her life and learn from. On a whole, Esther's life is not one you want to emulate at every point. But at this point, it's definitely one you want to emulate, okay? Let me give you four things I look in Esther's life and I say they should be true of every single Christian that's living out of their identity in ministry for gospel change. If you're an agent of gospel change, there's four things that you need to see. The first one is Esther had an urgency about her. Urgency is something that should be fundamental to the life of a believer who is on mission. See, for Esther, she understands the good news edict that now is written, that Mordecai wrote, that's going out on swift horses, this good news edict is only good news if it gets there before the death edict has been carried out. There's a time frame. The Jews are sitting under death. They're months away. If the good news edict doesn't get there before the death edict gets there, then what's the good of the news? Good news is only good news if it gets there in time. And I mean that for your neighbor, and I mean that for the Muslim who's sitting in Madhya Pradesh, India, right now. It's only good news if it gets there in time. I've used this illustration before. I think it's a really good illustration. You know, the War of 1812, there was a huge battle in the War of 1812 called the Battle of New Orleans. Maybe some of you have heard of it. It's actually where Andrew Jackson began to have a lot of prominence and, you know, a guy from our history, Andrew Jackson. And so the battle was fought in January of 1815. I mean, the lead is flying, bayonets, people dying, tooth and nail, extreme battle, January 1815. One problem. The Treaty of Ghent that ended the War of 1812 was signed on December 30th, 1814. They're fighting the battle in January where the war had ended 1 month earlier. Why? Swift horses, couriers running, people in ships as fast as they can go to get to New Orleans to say stop fighting and dying. Why? The war's over. Great news. Strike up the band. Good news. It's only good news if it gets there in time. You tell that to the guys that died at the battle. You see what I mean? It's good news when it gets there in time. The Bible says swift horses, royal stud, carriers going to all nations. Why does it tell us all of this? Y'all, it's supposed to be a picture for us to see the urgency of which the church should be on mission. Why? It's only good news if it gets there in time. It's urgent. The great missionary, Hudson Taylor, was a missionary to China. Upon seeing a dude converted in China, hearing the gospel message who had never heard it before, the guy looks at Hudson Taylor and he says, man, how long have you known this message of truth about Christ who takes our sin? And Hudson Taylor is thinking, man, I've known this a long time. And the guy says, no. I mean, like, in England, how long have your people known that there is truth that saves? Hudson Taylor kind of looked at the ground and he said, man, we've known for hundreds of years. Can you imagine being this dude, this Chinese guy? Hundreds of years? This is what he said. You've had these glad tidings for that long? He said, my father is dead. He searched for truth his whole life and never found it. It's only good news if it gets there in time. Mercy Hill, is there an urgency about us? And I mean to our neighbors, yes. That's what Esther's doing. She's not traveling. It's to her neighbors. But I also mean to the world. Is there an urgency about the way that we are getting on with the mission? Y'all, I want to say something very personally to you, all right? And I want you to hear this the right way. And I know some of you don't know me from Adam. Maybe your first time here tonight. I'm just going to have to ask you to trust me that this is by God's grace. And there's nothing arrogant in this at all right? Some of you know me very well, though, and you'll know, and I hope that you'll understand what I mean when I say this. The biggest fear that I have for this church, for Mercy Hill Church, is that our urgency cools. That we go from a church that was high urgency to a church that is satisfied. And I'm going to tell you why it scares me so much and why this is the biggest fear for me. Here it is. You ready? When you see a church go from 30 to 300 in a year, there is by God's grace, there is danger in that. The danger is that we all become, hey, man, we go to a cool church, things are happening, God's good, and what are we doing? Are we being missionaries? Are we being agents of change? I don't want this church to cool off. We have a big vision for this church. We have a big vision for this city. By God's grace, urgency. Let's continue to put that before us, all right? The second thing that I want you to see is this. And this is just so practical. There is a courage here. Urgency and courage. Y'all, at the beginning of this series, I put before you that I thought that I would put Esther and her courage up against any other Old Testament character. You name them. David, Jonathan, Gideon, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Anybody you want to pull a story out, I would put Esther at least equal to all of them. Why? Because what she did is scary. I walk in, it's either a thumbs up or a thumbs down on behalf of my people. It takes courage to be one who sees gospel change, who becomes an agent for gospel change. Now look, don't miss the identity piece, all right? I want to make sure I'm hitting that. You have been saved and sent. We gain our courage not by pulling our bootstraps up tomorrow and saying, I'm going to be more courageous. We gain more courage by realizing the same God that saved us is over us. And we can be courageous in the way that Esther was courageous. Whether the outcome is good or bad, we know that ultimately the outcome is good. We can be that, but are we that? Let me talk to the Christians in the room for just a minute. If you are a Christian, you have inherited a great, y'all, for centuries, Christians have been putting mission over fear. You've inherited that. Mission over fear. One of the early church fathers, Polycarp, he was martyred. He was about to be burned at the stake. Here's what he said. He said, 86 years I have followed him, and he has done me no wrong. How can I then blaspheme my king? Listen to what he said. Bring forth what you will. Burned and stabbed. you have inherited mission over fear. Hugh Latimer, 1555. He's about to be burned at the stake with a comrade of his for preaching the gospel, and this comrade of his getting very upset. He's getting very scared. This is his quote to his friend. About to be burned at the stake. "Be of good cheer, Mr. Ridley, and play the man. We shall this day light such a candle in England as I hope by God's grace shall never be put out." This is our inheritance of people who have gone before us. There is courage in being one who brings an agent of gospel change, all right? Let me say one other thing about this. There are some of you in this congregation that by God's grace, for some reason, you are just wired this way. When you were a little kid, you picked the highest tree and then you jumped off of it, okay? Some of you are just, and you know who I'm talking about. There's some of you who are just that type of man or woman. I think Esther was that type of girl. If that is how God has wired you, is it possible that, man, at Mercy Hill, here's what we say. One of our plumb lines at Mercy Hill is we want to send our best. We want to raise people up. With the best ones that we have, go plant another church. Go overseas and be a missionary. Go ahead and leave and multiply the gospel somewhere else. We want to send our best. Courage is part of that. God has gifted some of you with it. It might be that with it, you ought to land in India or Afghanistan or Indonesia and share the gospel in a place that's pretty hard, all right? Third thing is this. There's a willingness in Esther's life to identify with her people. The reason I said earlier that this is more courageous in chapter 8 than it was in chapter 4 is for this reason. In chapter 4, Esther goes in on behalf of herself and her people. She goes in and she's trying to save herself and her people. By chapter 8, she has been saved. Mordecai is now holding the signet ring. Esther's calling the shots for the kingdom in a lot of ways. She's out of the woods. What she decides to do now, though, is to say, I know I'm saved, but now I'm going to go and I'm going to step in on behalf of my people. I'm going to identify with them even all the way into death. Here's my question to you. Is there anybody on earth that you love that much to say, I'm saved, I'm comfortable, I'm fine, but I'm willing to step down and be identified with you, potentially marked for slaughter, in order that you would have the gospel? Well, Paul felt that way, didn't he? In Romans chapter 9, he said, I would give my salvation away in order that some of my brethren could have it. Is there anybody that you feel that strongly about? Fourthly and lastly, that I want you to see from Esther chapter 8, is that Esther is a woman who leverages her influence. Where are you influential in life? Wherever that is, if you feel the burden and passion for ministry, don't feel like you immediately have to come up to me and ask me where to go to seminary and how to become a pastor. God has you in an influential situation tonight. A teacher, a businessman, a stay-at-home mom. All of these things have influence. A college student. Everywhere you go, there is influence in your life. Are you willing to leverage that influence in order to see the gospel go forward? I think about my own little son, 2 years old. If he walked up to me when he's older and said, Dad, I want to preach the gospel and be a pastor like you. I'd say, son, that's awesome, man. If that's what God's putting in your heart, I want you to go for it. If he came up to me and said, Dad, I want to be a lawyer and work to affect gospel change in this city and to see those who are weak that can't be defended. And I want to go, as a lawyer, I want to advocate for God's people at the highest level I can. I would say, do that. Don't preach. I would say, run with that. AP, you would have a far greater impact probably than I ever will in an opportunity to do that. Some of you, God is placing vocational ministry on your heart. That's great. Run after that. Don't feel like you have to. Your whole life's a ministry. Where has God given you influence in your life? Will you be willing to leverage it? You know what? I'm gonna hit on a sore issue just for a second. The reality is that every single one of us has been given influence in the way that we leverage our resources, our money, the way that we leverage our time and our actions. Y'all, I'm gonna tell you something. In about a month, this church is gonna begin to hear about what we're gonna try to do for our Christmas missions offering in December. All the money that comes in is money that immediately goes right back out in this Christmas missions offering. And I promise you, we're already beginning to have meetings about it. We already have a number in our mind, and it is crazy. It's nuts. We're going to push everybody to give that we might be able to, as a church, leverage our money in order to give all of it away. Our church could use the money, okay? I mean, we're upfitting a facility. I mean, you know, you go to our offices for about 5 seconds, you're going to realize there is a lot we could do. All the money that comes in is going to go out, and we're going to ask you to do something crazy. Why? We believe in leveraging our influence for the sake of the lost. Are you doing that, all right? The entire book, we've seen that Esther has been pushed on by culture. But now through gospel change, she is the one that is pushing on culture and bringing, point number three, if you're taking notes, it's going to be quick, she's bringing joy to the city. That's the third thing that missionaries do. The entire city rejoiced. Are we that type of God's people that even the godless rejoice that we're here? The Jews are the ones that are saved, but the city rejoices. The Bible also said that when the Jews were going to be killed, the city kind of mourned. Why? For some kind of reason, God's people are being good neighbors. Listen, if Mercy Hill disappeared, would Greensboro notice? I give us a little bit of a break. We're 1 year old as a church. What about when we're five? What about when we're 10? Is Greensboro going to be affected in a way that rejoices and is joyful because we are here? It will be if we're truly the missionaries that God has called us to be, all right? Let me wrap this up. The Bible ends up saying that this edict of life goes out and joy is the result. Here's the last thing I want to say as I conclude. The edict only brings joy when it's believed. If you get the edict and you're like, nah, it looks like a forgery. I think we're still under an edict of death. There's no joy in that. But if the edict is believed, there is joy. That's a big point for those of you in the room that aren't believers and for those of you that are. If you're not a believer tonight, we've been pushing you throughout this whole series. Man, look at Esther, see Jesus, see that God is for you. Would you accept the joy that is there? A great theologian named C.S. Lewis, we quote him a lot around here. He wrote a book that was called Surprised by Joy. That was his memoir from going from a non-believer to a believer. The surprise was joy. You can have that joy here tonight if you would submit to Christ. But for some of you, you are believers in here tonight. And the end of this, the joy that we're talking about, you're not experiencing. The reality is that there's something in the edict of life that you may not be believing. It's true of you. You know, but there's something in you that is not believing it. Maybe deep down in your heart, Satan is lying to you. And you're like, man, I'm not joyful. I can't have joy in the gospel. Look at all this stuff I've done in the last year. How many times I've failed Christ. I can't have joy in this. That's indulgent. Look at how much bad stuff is going on in my life. I must be getting punished for this. It's things that you would never tell somebody else as given advice for them because you know it's not true, but you kind of don't know it's not true because you're believing it in your heart. The edict of life is joy and it's life-giving and it's freeing if it's believed. Church, let's put our faith there tonight, all right?